This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Morgan Simon, a leader in impact investment who builds bridges between finance and social justice. She supports clients, including the Libra Foundation, and is also co-founder and chair of the nonprofit Transform Finance. Morgan Simon is here to tell us about her book, Real Impact, The New Economics of Social Change. Welcome, Morgan.
Thank you so much.
Why did you write Real Impact? What is your purpose?
So impact investment is a trillion-dollar trend that most people have never heard of. And at the same time, it's this really exciting opportunity to be able to align your values with your money, or you could say the other way around, right? Your money with your values. And essentially, as the industry has been scaling, I think there's still a lot of questions around what impact is going to mean. And if you look at the Merriam-Webster definition of impact, it's to impinge upon, especially forcefully, right? Which doesn't sound very good. And as much as the goal of impact investment is to try to have a positive social and environmental impact on the world, Real Impact as a book is really about how do we kind of make sure that impact is real over time. And as we start to scale this industry, what do we really need to think about? And it also tries to provide some education for people if you are interested in, you know, how do I have my investment dollars really fulfill my social values? Of how do I do that? What are some of the places to start? What are some of the opportunities that are out there and to kind of see whether for yourself or for an institution you may be connected to, of ways of engaging.
How have you gone about trying to build a bridge between social justice and impact investment? Would you speak about your personal journey and efforts?
So I've been an impact investment for about 17 years and started a couple organizations. So one, the Responsible Endowments Coalition, which worked with the $400 billion that's on college campuses across the country. And then with individual investors as the CEO of Tonic, which is a network of impact investors globally, about $4.5 billion between them that are looking to support social and environmental entrepreneurs. And then over the last 6 years or so, Candide Group, which is my current firm that supports a couple families and foundations on how to implement impact investment across the portfolio. It's really been this combination of philosophy and kind of building the field and really figuring out what are the most appropriate spaces to make impact. And then the actual execution, right, which is that we've supported over 50 deals and funds over those last 6 years, and really trying to identify high-impact entrepreneurs that can make money while making a difference.
How have underserved and frontline communities been part of the conversation in developing your ideas on impact investing? In what ways have you worked together with them?
Sure. So one of the things in a social justice context we often talk about is this idea of nothing about us without us, right? Which is that you don't want to make decisions on behalf of other people in terms of what they should want or what their lives should look like. And that sometimes in impact investment, we can be guilty of kind of sitting on the 40th floor of the Wall Street Bank, making those sorts of decisions for people. And how do we make sure that we're really in touch with communities in a thoughtful way to be able to take leadership from affected communities? And for us, that means a number of things. You know, that means being really conscious of balancing out our social education with our finance education. So for instance, in the last 2 weeks, I was in one impact investment conference and then was also in the Zapatistas women gathering in the south of Mexico and, you know, learning from that autonomous community on how they've been able to sustain their economy over the past 20 years, or, you know, really making sure that we're in communication with global grassroots and then also domestically so that our decisions are really guided by them. So sometimes what we say internally is that rather than our clients being the families we work with, the idea is that the client is social justice and then we bring money to support it.
How have the social justice activists you have worked with responded to the idea of impact investing?
So I think it's been mixed in terms of a number of activists, I think, see a tremendous amount of opportunity with an impact investment, which is knowing that philanthropy is always going to be a tiny segment of society, right? So $196 trillion that circulates in the global economy every day, and somewhere, if I'm correct, around $60 billion in philanthropy that happens. Now, that's still a substantial amount, but it does lock you in this fairly David and Goliath fight if we're only going to have charitable resources to be able to support social change. So a number of activists have been looking at what are earned revenue models to be able to support social movements in a way that's much more autonomous and then also can result in greater resources. So that's one of how do we really use the tools to advance our goals much more quickly. And then the second has been some very reasonable trepidation in terms of the importance of holding impact investment accountable as it scales, of how do you make sure it's really serving community interests. And that's where I think activists can also get involved from an accountability perspective. So for instance, as we saw in the case of microfinance, which I think many people have heard of and have seen that it had a bit of a mixed track record, that sometimes providing finance at a very reasonable rate to low-income women would lead to prosperity, and sometimes providing it at very, very high rates would leave them even more impoverished, right? And how do you make sure that you're doing the right thing? So I think that's another space where activists can really play a pivotal role, especially as we're seeing just the sheer amount of money moving into impact investment, that it's set to eclipse development aid by as much as 10 times over the next decade. So if that's where a lot of money for social change is coming from, how do we make sure that it's really doing the right things?
In your book, you speak about choosing systemic change over palliative change in impact investing projects. Would you explain?
So the term palliative change, right, we often think about palliative care, which in the medical profession, right, is the idea of making someone more comfortable while they might be going through a life transition, right? The idea that you might make things a little bit better in the short term, but it's still a terminal case. And I would say similarly that when we're looking at people who are in extremely difficult life circumstances, right, that might be surviving on $2 a day or $7 an hour, that the idea of making them just a little bit better off, right, $2 to $3 a day, is palliative, is saying that we still think it's appropriate for people to live in abject poverty, but that we're going to make it a little bit more pleasant in the short term. And when we think about systemic change, we really come from the perspective of saying, if I believe that all people are created equal, I want them to equally have opportunities to thrive. And I want to make sure that I'm really going beyond the basics to creating a much higher quality of life. So that's where we start to look at interventions that are much more systemic in terms of addressing economic inequality. And similarly, in contexts like renewable energy, right? Of can we really create grid-level renewables that are going to have the potential to really displace the fossil fuel economy?
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Morgan Simon, author of the book, Real Impact, The New Economics of Social Change. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. In what ways do you see impact investment failing to reach its full potential? You speak about that in the book. What current drawbacks do you see?
So I think impact investment, two things. One is that we need a lot more of it, right? That I think there's still not a lot of awareness amongst the average consumer that they have the opportunity to make different choices. And I think sometimes we have to remember, you know, whether we work with a financial advisor or just have our money at the bank, that sometimes when we give that money to the bank, we feel like it's no longer ours, right? That it's now theirs to do as they like, and that they're doing us just the service of holding it. But we have to remember that that's our money, and that means that it can reflect our values and that we need to hold those institutions accountable or go to different institutions. So that can be as simple as having your money in a community bank or an environmental bank where you're getting the same types of services and the same financial return generally, but are able to make sure it's reflecting your values. And then similarly, if you have a retirement fund, right, of is there a social and environmental option? And if there's not, is that something you can talk to your employer about? So first is just for more people to feel empowered that they can make those choices and that the options really are out there. And I think that's been the most exciting thing about impact investment over the last 10 years, that there are so many places that people can go if they're interested in doing this type of investing. And one of the chapters in the book is going through 4 easy steps for an ick-free life, right? The idea that 4 steps you could take in 20 minutes or less to be able to move your money to things that are more socially and environmentally responsible. So that's certainly one in terms of just given all the great progress so far of how can we really go further. And then second is just making sure the impact is real, right? Going back to that question of palliative versus systemic, are we really, you know, given the global challenges out there, working at a pace that's fast enough and extensive enough to really create a new economy that can serve people on the planet? And that's where I feel great that we have a lot of really bright, determined people in the industry who just need to kind of align around what are the key questions that we need to figure out and to kind of have that long-term dedication to impact.
So how can impact investing be done right and reach its full potential? What are the key principles?
So in the context of Transform Finance, which is a nonprofit that I co-founded that basically is organizing investors and then also provides trainings to activists on how to get more engaged on impact investment, there's three main principles that we follow. So the first is to add more value than we extract. And that goes back to, you know, not just making someone a little bit better off, but making sure that a transaction is really fair. We also try to engage communities in design, governance, and ownership, right? So not just treating them as consumers or producers, but the actual protagonists. And then finally, balancing risk and return between investors, entrepreneurs, and communities to make sure that everybody truly benefits from a transaction. And the idea is that those are principles that can really apply cross geographies and cross sectors and that are really more about the structure of how business and the economy works.
What are some examples of your principles being put into practice in successful impact investment projects?
So one organization that I would highlight is called The Working World, which has a nonprofit fund based out of New York. And they work on worker-owned cooperatives as a really great opportunity for generally low-income workers to be able to transition to being owners. And one of the things that we've seen, particularly with the racial wealth gap in the U.S., that it's not just about wages, but very much about assets. And like the recent study that had come out in the Boston Globe, that whereas the average white family had assets of over $200,000, the average Black family had assets of $8. And that means that even if you earn the same wages, it would take generations to be able to catch up. So ownership is the opportunity to really narrow that asset gap substantially. And the Working World has been financing a number of worker-owned co-ops across the country, predominantly led by people of color, and really fulfilling that promise around adding more value than they extract from communities and engaging communities as owners and not just as consumers.
In your book, you describe two projects from Mexico, one with impact investing gone wrong and the other with impact investing done right. Would you compare the two?
Sure. So one of the things that we see is that question of what's at stake if you forget to ask the community how they feel about a project. And I'll note that this is dangerous both from a social perspective and from a financial perspective, what people sometimes call the social license to operate, right, which is making sure a local community is aligned with your plans. So I speak in the book about a project in rural Mexico, an attempt to create the largest wind farm in the country, which would have been a fantastic way to lessen fossil fuel dependency in an indigenous community. So the opportunity for local job creation, and then with great investor returns, at least that was the expectation. And it was a number of development banks and investors, Mexican government, corporate partners who were engaged in this project and seemed like a great idea for everyone, except for the people who lived there, who were often asked to sign contracts in Spanish and not their native languages, who were being given as little as $50 per hectare in a $550 million project. So once the community really learned what was going on, started putting up roadblocks, and there were a number of shootings of 12 different people in the community. And ultimately, the Indigenous Association had to put out a statement, stop the intimidation, hostility, and violence associated, you know, not with war, not with oil and gas, but with wind energy. And I would posit that those are three words, intimidation, hostility, and violence, that I would never want associated with impact investment, right? And where they got it wrong was not making sure to provide sufficient benefit to the community, right? A recognition of it's their land and they should get to be protagonists in the story as well. And the success story or the model of how it could be done better is that there was a local group called Grupo Yansa that, in working with the community, started working on starting a community-owned wind farm, of saying it's not that we're against wind, it's just that we're against losing our land and losing value. How could we do this ourselves? So that's a model and a project that's still in process, but it points to how you could have the opportunity to still produce investment returns while making sure that the community gets to fairly participate in that process.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Morgan Simon, author of the book Real Impact, The New Economics of Social Change. How do you fairly structure who takes on the most risk and who gets the most return from a project funded by impact investing?
So I think in the context of impact investing, we want to think about capital as a resource like any other, right? So if I'm making, let's say I'm a hamburger joint, right? And I have to pay a cost for the meat and the bun and the lettuce and the tomato, right? And I'm factoring all of that into the price of my product. And similarly, I'm paying for financing, right? That money has a cost. And when we think about something like a bank loan, right, that cost is the interest. And I guess when we start to set an interest rate, we're thinking about two different things, right? One is the need of the financier, and need, you know, between quotes, is often something that's very personal, right? It depends kind of how you feel about your level of wealth. So for some people, they may feel that the world has kind of unfairly bestowed them with too much and they want to be giving back. Others may be saving for a specific goal like retirement and really feel they want to maximize financial return. So some of that is on the side of the investor. And then the other is on the side of the recipient of what is really a fair price for them to pay for capital in the context of all their other needs and costs and how useful the services to the community they are providing it to. So I think it's always a delicate dance, but that it needs to be something else than just as much money as possible. You know, and I think that's often what we presume the objective is of finance, is just to make as much money as possible. If you think from kind of a broader perspective that it's to create as much value as possible, I want that value to be distributed fairly between different players. And that means that capital should be paid for its contribution, but so should people, and making sure that everyone is getting to benefit in the process.
Could you give an example of a project that attempted to meet these goals?
So going back to that example of the working world in supporting worker-owned cooperatives, part of what makes them unique as well is that they don't just set an interest rate arbitrarily in terms of saying, well, our bank needs, they're not a bank, but loan fund, needs 8%. So that's what it's going to be. They say, we want to make sure to add more value than we extract. And therefore, we're going to make sure that the business is benefiting first and foremost. And after we know that it's profitable and it's supporting the workforce, then we as investors can take our returns. And what's nice about that is that it really aligns investors and the workers towards the same purpose, right? Which is to create wealth for everybody, as opposed to saying we need to work just so that we can pay back the bank, which is much less motivating, right? As opposed to we need to work because it's going to make everybody more prosperous. So I think they've come to this great balance of making sure to take on most of the risk of saying that the people with the money are in better position to take on risk than those without. But that also we want to make sure that we're aligned in trying to support this business to success.
Are there additional impact investment projects that you would like to highlight?
There are so many. And I think what I would highlight more than any particular one is just the fact that regardless of what your social interest might be, right, whether you're kind of generally just care about social change, or if you're really passionate about food justice or housing or education or global poverty, right, that there's opportunities to invest in all these different spaces and support a very different vision for the world. And that's also true across asset classes, right? So whether going to a community bank or looking at a private debt fund or looking at ways to infuse impact into private equity or to real estate, that there's ways to do this for both individuals and institutions across all sorts of sectors, geographies, and asset classes.
What are some of the challenges in scaling impact investment?
So over the last decade, more traditional financial institutions have gotten engaged in impact investment, which has been fantastic because these institutions really have the experience of scale and are able to get products out to mass market in a much, much more streamlined way. The one thing we have to be careful of is that when something is scaled based on its financial value, which is sort of what had happened with microfinance, you sometimes have this lagging access of the social side. And that's where we need to make sure as we're scaling impact investment, we scale the impact part just as much as the investment part. And that means making sure to have really balanced teams that have equal experience in terms of understanding the dynamics of social change and understanding the dynamics of finance, and that there's much more of that grassroots connection in these big institutions and opportunities to be able to invest in smaller projects as opposed to just massive scale. So there's a lot that can be borrowed from traditional finance, but there's a lot that also needs to be added and brought to the table of finance to make sure that it can be much more socially responsible.
Would you say more about how impact investors can be made accountable to social movements in the communities where they work?
Sure. So I think there's a couple very concrete examples that I can provide. And some of it is really just about when a project says that it's social, you know, that it's supporting people or supporting the environment, what is the local response to that, right? So for instance, what an investor might call workforce housing, that sounds like a good thing, can sometimes mean that it's at a percentage of medium income that's so high that it's really not deemed to be accessible by community activists who might be supporting fights against gentrification. So how do we make sure that there's much more of a dialogue there and that just saying something is social doesn't necessarily mean it is? And some of that, and that's part of why Transform Finance does a training specifically for activists to be able to get to know impact investment, to say that, you know, finance doesn't have to be complicated and unapproachable. I think it's given that reputation in part to try to keep us away from it, right? And I think that if we're able to come to a comfort level to say, yes, I can understand this deal and I see where it is and isn't benefiting my community, that's a very powerful posture to be able to come from. And that's what Transform Finance wants to really create for people, is that opportunity to feel more empowered to hold projects accountable to their stated impact.
You mentioned in your book this idea of the accidental billionaire. Would you explain?
Sure. So I think often we kind of divide in our minds this haves and have-nots, right? If I'm not part of the 1%, I don't have economic power. But any of your listeners who have a college degree, right, means they're connected to an alma mater with an endowment that may have hundreds of millions to billions of dollars. Anyone who's a teacher is part of a pension fund that is going to likely be in the billions to trillions of dollars. And that if you kind of chase your connections in the world, anyone who has a bank account, we're all connected to billion-dollar institutions one way or another that are managing our money, right? It's not their money, it's our money. And that means that the opportunities to really weigh in are quite abundant. And for example, every time that your alma mater sends you a letter in the mail asking you to donate, writing back saying, well, where is my money going? You know, where is this being invested? And is it a way that's in line with an institution's values? Or in a pension fund of, did they vote their proxy statements this year to hold corporations accountable that they're invested in? So I think some of it is certainly how we can personally manage our money differently, but then also how we can be much more active participants in the institutions that we're connected to.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I think two things. One is that for people who are already part of the impact investment field or the financial field generally, to get to really dive in deeper from an impact perspective. And, you know, given that it's really chronicling my work over the last 17 years, of getting a really wide range of what impact investment can mean. And I specifically tell the story of how we brought one family from 0% impact investments to 100% across asset classes and in kind of the technical implementation side. And then for a more general public, it's really designed as a book where you don't need to know anything about finance. And that's part of why Real Impact, the New Economics of Social Change, right? It doesn't have finance or investing on the cover. That it's really very story driven. And it's the idea of presenting impact investment as the next big idea, as something that people who care about social change should know about and can access. So it's really designed to be very easy reading.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think for those who have been excited about the idea of aligning their money with their values, to just choose a first step, right? Of whether it's something like moving your cash to a bank that you feel is really values aligned, or talking to your retirement fund administrator about different options that might be out there, that you don't have to do everything at once, but that at least taking a first step can get you so much further.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Morgan.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Morgan Simon, author of the book Real Impact: The New Economics of Social Change, published in October 2017 by Nation Books. For more information, check on the web at morgansimon.com. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to the podcast section of KEXP's website at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and at kexp.org.